Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. 1926 was the year that Americans all over the country said screw it. And screw it they did, mixing too much bootleg booze, marijuana, cocaine, and heroin with fast cars, sex, and jazz music can only lead to trouble. The number of allegedly normal people senselessly committing ghastly murders in 1926 is astounding. It is like a switch got turned on and some people went mad, unlike any other time in American history. The book that we're featuring this evening is 1926, Homicide in America, with my special guest journalist and author, David Kolchick. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview. Again, David Kolchick.
Hey, it's always great being on this show, and I'd like to thank you and your listeners for liking me.
Thank you very much for joining us once again for your latest book. Let me ask this. What was the impetus for this book, 1926, Homicide in America?
Well, while I was writing my other five books mostly about California crime, they all were about California crime, I kept finding things happening in 1926 that were just outrageous. A lot of them weren't happening in California, so I didn't include them in the book, although I have in my other books, like the Terror Bandits of San Francisco happened in 1926. Tanko and Hall happened in 1926. They were two murderers, that cop killers that escaped from San Quentin, were on the run for a long time. It's pretty crazy. Happened all through the middle of California. So I'm finding all these odd things. And so I started a file and I started putting away, you know, the news clippings of what these crimes had happened, and came up to it. And I decided I had enough so that I could write a book about it. The weird thing about what happened there is that people, they were fooled by World War One, you know, God and country, everybody went out there and everybody, you know, so many people got killed, but so many people were injured, severely injured. There were laws in some towns that if you were missing a leg or an arm, you had to, you couldn't be out in certain, like the business district during the daytime. People were just, a lot of people had damage to their lungs, and a lot of soldiers during World War One, it took them 10 years to die. You know, same thing in World War Two. My father had a cousin who died in 1953 from the effects of what happened to him in World War Two. And so after a war like that, and then they had the Spanish flu pandemic, so everyone knew somebody who died. The pandemic flu, the Spanish flu, killed young people and healthy people. It kind of left older and sick people alone. But you would get it, and you'd be dead. You'd be dead in 48 hours. You'd just start coughing blood, just splatter. So everyone knew. My wife's grandmother, her parents, actually it would be her great-grandparents, died in the epidemic. And her grandmother was an orphan. You know, it's like everyone knew somebody who died. People were just going like, you know, what's the point? You know, what's the point of everything? You know, when they saw death, you know, what else could scare them? What else could bother them? And well, at the same time, we had prohibition here in America where they outlawed alcohol, which brought everything underground and made it all into a big party. You had the rise of jazz music, which was something that, you know, people never heard anything like it. I've been reading some other stories about my friend Bill Berg here in Sacramento, the historian. He's writing about a section of Sacramento that was torn down during urban renewal to put the freeway through. And, you know, jazz music hit Sacramento like crazy. It all happened in the early 20s, and people never heard things like that. So, you know, then we also had women had the right to vote. And both my grandmothers were able to vote in the very first election because of that. But, you know, women started saying, you know, hey, I don't need these Victorian rules. And, you know, they got rid of the corsets and started relaxing a bit, showing some leg, smoking cigarettes, going out unescorted, you know, moving out by themselves. There's a lot of things happening. Caused a lot of friction among families and things, you know. And at the same time, too, while things were being modernized, there were some people that had, you know, a guaranteed job like a blacksmith or something, or the quintessential buggy whip maker, completely lost their occupations and just disappeared, you know, kind of like a linotype writer or something, you know. So all these changes were happening. And at the same time, this is what I think caused the whole thing. It was the first modern epiphany, is that in 1926, ABC or NBC, the National Broadcasting Corporation, had simultaneously been able to broadcast coast to coast a show all at the same time. So everyone in the country was hearing the same thing. First time in history, everyone was listening to the same thing. And it's kind of like, you know, the moonshot that just happened, the 50-year anniversary, you know, and everyone was like, wow, you know, look at that. The same thing kind of happened, except they weren't as articulate about it. You know, there was still a lot of not much modern thinking. People were really stuck in a lot of old world ways. So they didn't realize what was actually really happening. Mm-hmm. So all these things combined, you know, along with fast cars, you know, cars were all of a sudden, they were pretty affordable. The economy in the cities were booming. Almost every city in the United States, their original downtown was built during the 1920s, the mid-1920s. Almost all of San Francisco, of the downtown, of the old buildings, was built during that time. So it was very prosperous. People had money. They had, you know, money to drink. They had money to buy cars. They had money to go out and have long, drunken, drug-filled weekends. It was something
but
different
as you write,
in America.
But as you write, this is a time that, unlike any other time in American history, I mean, you talked about all the conditions that were ripe for this to happen. But despite that, this is an unusual time, regardless, this 1926. Let's talk about one of the first stories that you, that really, I guess, jumps out at you at this book. This story, The Urge for Overkill, June 28th, 1926, and it goes to May 26, 1927, a year. And you talk about Evelina Rohl and her friend. She's looking for her friend, so she goes to the house looking for her. Tell us about what happens at the Rohl house and this friend and what she finds along with her father that one day when they go to see her friend.
Well, the Rohls lived in a big house in the old part of Tampa. I guess it's called the Canal District. And Tampa at that time was a major port to Cuba and the Caribbean and stuff. Very busy, prosperous place. There's about 50,000 people there. So they had this big house, extended family, uncles, aunts, nieces, the grandmother. She was anywhere between 96 and 101 years old. They all lived in this house. And in this big house, they had a lot of, you know, social things happening. And they also rented out some rooms to boarders and stuff. So this girl, Eva, or Ruby, comes over to Eva Rowland's house. They were going to go look for a job together. They had some interviews, and Ruby's father was going to drive them around so that, you know, it could be a lot nicer. She goes to the door, and there's no one there. And, you know, this house is pretty much awake 24/7 with, you know, the range of ages of people in the house and stuff. She looked through the window and saw a bloody body laying there. So the police show up, and not everybody that lives in the house is there. You know, some people had some jobs out of town. Some people were just staying over somewhere else. They find four bodies there. Eva was still alive, but she died in the hospital a couple hours later without gaining consciousness. Everybody's head was bashed in with a railroad spike, which is like a hammer with a spike on the end of it.
Right.
So her 45-year-old Uncle B, which is, isn't that a great name, Uncle B, and her grandmother Caroline and a boarder, who's 36-year-old Charles Anderson, were all just all chopped up. So the cops, you know, they thought, oh, was this a crime thing? And they, you know, arrested everybody that had visited them in the last day. And after a year, it went cold. They could not figure out who killed this whole family. And so a year later, and this is weird how I found this story, is that originally I just found the murder story. And then later, while I was really doing the research for this book, I was scouting through Tampa papers, and I found the conclusion of this, which is, this is like one of the strangest yes. murder cases I have ever come across.
Absolutely.
So a year later, on May 26, 1927, there's like a three-room house, and this little kid that lived there, 8-year-old, Hugh Merrill, who woke up on the floor of his bedroom, he'd fallen out of bed, and he went to his parents' room, and he found them dead. He ran through the house, found the 16-year-old brother who was coming home from there. They killed a baby. The husband and wife, an 11-year-old, a 5-year-old, and a 3-month-old baby, they all had their heads crushed in. And so the police are going like, what is going on here, you know? And turns out that there's this guy who was so strange. He was a heroin addict. His name was Benjamin Franklin Levins. And he was hanging out with this other guy, and they were drinking, you know, like raw alcohol and trying to score heroin and stuff. And they were just loud in bars, and they went to a fortune teller and asked if they were going to get caught. And a couple of people probably called, you know. But these guys, the cops ended up picking these guys up, and this Levins guy was a fisherman and a dope fiend for amusement, and he admitted right off that he killed that family. And it turned out that one of the Rowells family lived at that house until recently, and they had moved, and a new family moved in. He broke into the house because he wanted to kill them, so hopefully he wouldn't get caught with his crime or something. Who knows what was going on in his brain, you know? This guy was very chemically dependent. So he broke in. His buddy pointed it out to him, said, yeah, it's where one of those guys lived that was in that murder, you know? And he broke into their house and killed them all, 5 people. And so the people in Tampa were furious, you know. The Rowell family were longtime residents there, and they wanted to lynch the guy. And they went to the jail, started throwing bricks and things, but the police had already gotten him like 3 counties away into another jail because they knew right. this was going to happen. So like 3,000 people, like for 3 nights in a row, kept on barricading the jail, throwing bricks. A group of them actually had a big timber, a beam, and they bashed a hole in the side of the jail, and they were met with shotgun pellets and all arrested. So the National Guard gets called in, and they set up and stuff with machine guns. And somebody in the crowd, no one knows, it's the way it always happens, you know, no one knows who shot first or what happened, but they ended up opening fire, and they killed 5 more people that were just there.
Yeah.
And one person was just like walking by, had nothing to do with what was going on. This guy hit with some bullets. So they ended up getting they let the leaders go into the jail to see that the guy wasn't there, you know, just to cool everything off because it was going crazy. So, they took him to trial, and he was like, they beat the confession out of me and stuff. And he was like found guilty like right away. Is just because of this one guy, it turns out that the reason why he killed in the house in 1926 is that he went to see the boarder, the person who was just renting a room from them, Charles Anderson. They went to discuss with him about some female jealousy problem, and he ended up smashing him in the head. And he realized that he would be caught, so he just kept quiet until everybody went to bed in the house. And there were actually, like, visitors visiting the teenagers, and then there was, like, a card party happening in the kitchen with Uncle B. And he killed the mom, that was the reason. Then he killed the other people because he thought that was a relative of them. So because of this one guy, 14 people died.
You write about the interesting...
Including the protesters.
Yeah. You talk about the interesting trial of his cohort, Thompson, which you write that when they drank this ethanol, it looked like this Thompson passed out, and he did the carnage himself. Richard did the carnage himself. Now, he was supposed to testify because he admitted to killing in Orlando. Benjamin Franklin Levins admitted to it. What does he do at the trial of Leonard Thompson? What's when Thompson is facing what? The death penalty. Tell us what happens.
Yeah, they brought in Levin, and he told the court that he had committed the murders alone, and Thompson had nothing to do with the crimes, and they had no alternative but to release him. They discharged the guy, and he went on with his life. He's probably a pretty lucky guy. He didn't commit the crime, so I can see, but it's actually almost commendable for a person like Levins to actually save one person's life.
Yeah.
But
it's something honorable, but,
after the murder, I didn't even include this. This is, like, really important. After the murder, the first murders, Levins went and signed up on a fishing boat and was, like, in the Gulf of Mexico for a whole year. That's why he was gone. He just signed up right away and, you know, left town, and no one knew what to look for him. And when he finally came back, and he opened his mouth. That was one of the craziest. I can't really think of anything as crazy as that crime.
Well, we've got some more in your book here. Let's talk about Panic in Cicero, Illinois, on July 11th, 1926. And maybe you can help me out with the pronunciation. James Crisius. And you say he was angry and wanted revenge. Tell us about James Crisius, why he was angry and wanted revenge.
Well, James Crisius was this guy who was working in a manufacturing plant in Chicago, and the owner's son told him to use this one lathe that everyone knew was unsafe. And so he protested. He did it anyways, and he lost his finger. Hang on a second. I have everything marked in my book, but of course that's...
I could tell you. He lost his left thumb in the industrial accident at work.
Yeah.
And then the owner's son, Saul Schwartz, had, like you say, he had insisted that he operate this lathe. And then after that, you say he wasn't compensated for his injury whatsoever.
Yeah.
And then with his thumb missing and his hand bandaged, what was his fate in terms of trying to find work? And what was his inevitable fate as a result?
Yeah, thanks. He wasn't even compensated. He was fired for losing his thumb.
Mm-hmm.
And so he just ended up becoming homeless, sleeping in parks or flea bag motels, and he met this guy named Thomas McWain. Now, he said later in his trial that he wanted to rob to get money to get a good attorney so he could sue his former boss. But, you know, these guys were both drug addicts too, you know. And a lot of people don't think about it, but, you know, there was a lot of people were doing heroin and speed and cocaine and crazy stuff like that. And so these guys, that's kind of all they did. And he met this Thomas McWain guy who was not much better than Crisius. He ordered a mail order gun. They got it like in a week. And they went out and robbed some people like almost right away. They got a ruby ring and $28, which isn't that bad of a score. The next day, just before midnight, they flagged down a cab. And this guy named Ludwig Rose was the driver. And they wouldn't really give him a address to go to. When he finally said, hey, you know, I got to know where I'm going. poked a gun in the back of his head, and then stopped. They took his uniform, tied him up with snow tire chains and stuff, and took his cash box. And the weird thing is, the terror bandits in San Francisco did the same thing, where they got a cab driver and they got his clothes and stuff, and then they shot and killed him. So I guess it's always been bad, a hard time to be a cab driver. So these guys started driving around looking for somebody to rob. Just after midnight, they saw 19-year-old Mary Blaine, who worked in the offices of Cracker Jack's. And she was with her kind of suitor, Frederick Hine, who was like a church singer, church Sunday school, and stuff like that. And they belonged to the same church in Cicero. Cicero. That's where Al Capone had his headquarters, too. It was completely bought by the mobsters and things. So they're sitting in front of her house. They just got back from, like, a church service or something. They were doing something at their church. And McWayne and Christmas pulls up. And they jump out, want his money. And Hine had the collection money from their evening meeting. And they just shot him in the head. Just boom. And then they shot Marie, just like dead, right in the head, both of them, just headshots. And they took the money, jumped back in the cab, and rode off. And Rose was still tied up. The cabbie was still in the back seat, and he heard all this. And they started driving fast, and he kicked the door open somehow and managed to fall out of the cab. So the bandits stopped, and they just got out and shot him dead right there. So now there's three people dead in this little problem. They ended up wrecking their car, and McWayne got caught. He was pinned. And the cops took him to the jail, the Cook County Jail, and then on the way they stopped at the morgue where Marie was just dropped off on the slab, you know, with a big hole in her forehead. And the guy totally just cracked and said everything he knew. But, you know, he only knew Crisis as Eddie. And, you know, he went after another name too. So everyone's looking for this Crisis guy. And it turns out he was hiding on a roof of this apartment building. It's still there too. That whole neighborhood is really intact. It's actually quite fascinating. And he hung out on the roof next to like the, you know, gable thing or something. And, it kind of bothered some of the tenants asking for food and stuff. They're kind of wondering, hey, what's this guy coming around their apartments for? So later in the day, the two people that lived in the building, they noticed the trap door, the roof was open, and they went up there, and it was it's where he was hiding out. They found Rose's chauffeur cap and coat, a watch, the ruby ring from the earlier robbery.
Yeah.
And they found a glove with the left thumb was stuffed with paper because, you know, the guy didn't have his hand. A bunch of scribble and stuff. They ended up getting them down from there, but it was, you know, kind of really frightening for the people that lived there that they realized that there's this multi-killer that was just like on a roof in a real urban area. You know, it was like real apartments just, you know, wall to wall up and down the street. So. Yeah, both of those guys got the death sentence and were hung at the scaffolds of Cook County Jail. And the weird thing about this, was kind of funny thing about it, is that, you know, they had in the papers, they had about the execution. They had a sidebar about the executioner because it was his last execution. He was the jail's plumber. And he said, I'm 60 years old. I've had enough of this job. I'm going out to California to take a rest. That was his 65th execution.
Yeah. You talk about, too, and continue with that story, in that he had a semi-literate notebook where he left, a suicide note, but it was very interesting.
Yeah.
Sort of said, goodbye, everybody. Not all my fault. It was their own faults. I wish I died myself instead. And he said, never be peace on earth. Too many hogs. Goodbye, old earth.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he had left something behind.
Yeah, you know, and this is a strange thing also about what in 1926 is that all these people left their big letters behind and, you know, big notes. There's like this minister in Montana who was basically he had his life ruined by area politicians. And so he shot the rest of his family and he wrote like these 500 word letters, you know, to who may concern and things. And other ones did too. I wonder if they were less, more literate back then. Like,
well,
the
they were literate.
Phantom killer.
Obviously, as we'll see. Yeah, that'll be the next up for sure. We'll discuss. Do you talk about
that
they were...
About... Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I we were going to say the same thing about being more literate, Dixon. Or, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I just want to mention that they both received a death sentence, and they were scheduled to be hanged on New Year's Eve, 1926, and they were hung that day, as you're right.
Oh. Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, they were on New Year's Eve. Yeah, tell ya. I think, you know, you think back then, in people had movies to watch. You know, you had to leave your house to go see it, though. And the thing you had was like a radio that you could play or play your piano or something like that. A lot of people knew how to play piano, and they would buy sheet music just like people would buy records or do downloads now. You know, they wanted to hear the latest song, they'd go buy it, and then they'd play it. It was all these people could sight read, and they wrote very, you know, flowery letters about things.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a limited form of communication, and so obviously, just like today, maybe we're using short forms and emojis and things to express, but we're still communicating in the popular mode of the time. And so, if we're going to try to impress somebody with a profile on a dating site or a profile on Facebook, we would put our best photo forward, and we put our best thoughts forward, our best description of ourselves. So again, probably flowery description of ourselves and our potential love for somebody else. And just like as we see in the 1926, that despite the flowery, you know, wording, that there was a very murderous time as well. We're going to use this as an opportunity, David, to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is Native. At Native, we create safe, simple, effective products that people use in the bathroom every day. We create products with trusted ingredients and trusted performance. Not convinced? Check out the 8,000 five-star reviews from our customers. Formulated without aluminum, parabens, and talc. Filled with ingredients found in nature, such as coconut oil, which is antimicrobial, shea butter, moisturizer and emollient, and tapioca starch, which absorbs wetness. No animal testing, free shipping, and returns. It works. Don't hold back. Native can hang with your workout, busy mom life, or 16-hour day. We have over 8,000 five-star reviews. Check out us out in today's show, Women's Health, Elle, Good Morning America, Pop Sugar, Nylon, Hello Giggles, and more. Less is more with Native. We have fewer, simpler ingredients, so you know everything that's in our deodorant. Aluminum may be linked to some serious health ramifications. Although Native is priced at a slight premium when compared to conventional deodorants, it is safe and effective. Native comes in a wide variety of enticing scents for men and women. Plus, we release new, limited edition seasonal scents throughout the year. We also offer an unscented formula and baking soda-free formula for those with sensitivities. Classic deodorant scents include coconut and vanilla, most popular scent, lavender and rose, cucumber and mint, and eucalyptus and mint. No risk to try. We offer free returns and exchanges in the U.S. Subscribe and save 17%. Save $2 per stick and have Native conveniently delivered to your door every 1, 2, 3, or 4 months. I tried the lavender and rose deodorant. I really liked it. It was not sticky at all. It was a real clean application. And I got to say, it smelled great and it was very, very effective. For 20% off your first purchase, visit nativedeodorant.com and use promo code TRUEMURDER during checkout. For 20% off your first purchase, visit nativedeodorant.com and use promo code TRUEMURDER during checkout. That's Native. Now, David, we were last talking about, and you just alluded to, one of the most fascinating stories in this collection of fascinating stories, and that is the Phantom Killer, Willard Carson, born in 1902, and this takes place in, he was born in Liberty, Indiana, on a farm, and his parents, Clinton and Minnie Carson, which are very important to this story. And tell us a little bit about Willard Carson and his life and what happens.
Well, Willard Carson was, you almost have to say he was like a proto-beatnik. He was born, like I said, in 1902, and Liberty, Indiana is pretty close to the Ohio border. This whole chapter takes place between that small area, probably only 50 miles square, between the two states. So Willard, his parents were successful farmers. His father actually sold out in his early 50s and moved to a big house in town. But Willard, he like lost interest in school, dropped out in eighth grade, and he left home. And he lived out in the woods around this area. And this is a small town. There's only 1,000 people there. It's all just, you know, cornfields and the great Midwest, you know. He made his own camp and went to the library and checked out books of, existential literature, dime novels. He just read it all the time. So he'd get in trouble every now and then, and his parents would bail him out. You know, he was kind of they gave him money all the time, and he was kind of a spoiled kid. He only had an older sister. So he was living out rough in a forest camp, and he'd drink and read books and hang out in the pool hall. And, of course, in a small town like that, they actually had a police force, which is kind of hard to believe, a town of 1,000 people. This officer started giving him some grief in the pool hall for being public intoxicated, and Willard pulled out a gun and fired at the deputy. Didn't hit him or anything, but he just took off and he just disappeared. And that's a trait that will follow him throughout his life. This guy would just vanish. He was like a phantom. And he must have been a really likable guy because he had a lot of friends who helped him throughout his long, weird career. And he had a thing for the ladies, too, evidently, because he had a girlfriend who was a 19-year-old married mother of two. Her name was Gladys Quick. And she had gotten him out of town, took him to, like, another town, got him on a train, and got him out of there. And he was just going to hang out until he came down, and he was, hopefully his father was going to get a good lawyer, and they would just kind of give him a fine or something. So he's living like 20 feet. He has like a tree house 20 feet up in the air in this tree, and had all kinds of comforts there. He was really mad he needed money. He came to his brother-in-law's place on his farm and asked for money, and he's like, I don't have any money till after the harvest. You know, this is in July. So he was furious that his parents didn't help him out. So on the night of August 3rd, 1926, and August 3rd is my wife's birthday, and there's a lot of murders happen on that day for some reason. And I always see that. It's like, yeah, that was my wife's birthday, you know? And it's like, but a lot of them. Actually, in this book, I think there's like three that happened on that day. So about 4 in the morning, he used a ladder, climbed upstairs on the roof, got into his parents' bedroom. And as he's climbing in through the window, he tripped over a sewing machine and woke up his parents. His father, Clinton, sat up in bed, and Willard shot him 4 times with a .38 caliber revolver. One of them hit him in the face, one in his hand, and the third in the chest. And then he put the barrel up to his father's forehead and fired one more time.
Yeah.
And so his mother, while this was happening, she jumped out the window and broke her back and stuff, but she got out of there. He stole his father's car. And after this, man, he never stopped. So, you know, the cops always thought, they were always watching to see if he was going to come back into town and stuff. But, you know, he had a lot of friends that helped him out. And the cops kicked down the doors of all his friends and things and couldn't find out anything to happen. So, in November he went to his brother's house again, tried to get money, and he called the cops, and they actually sent up airplanes, and they couldn't find him. So,
yeah.
A year later, he's in Kokomo, Indiana. He's renting a room from this 50-year-old guy named Alonzo Whalen, and he was using the name Edgar Dixon, and he was there with his wife and his kid. He kind of moved fast.
Yeah.
So this guy, his landlord, again, gets suspicious of him because, you know, he's like, this guy just reads books and stuff. And I guess that was weird then or something. But he went and told the police. And so the police came over there with soldiers from the Indiana National Guard. And he was gone. And they found his wife, Irene, this kid. And she didn't know. She met him in November 1926 in Indianapolis. And got married to him. She always knew him as Edgar Dixon. She had no idea that he was this wanted murderer, Willard Carson. So about a year later, May 3rd, 1929, Alonzo, his old landlord that squealed on him, was sitting in his chair by his window after dinner chatting with his wife, and Carson had a double-barrel shotgun and blew his head off through the window and disappeared. So he's got this vengeance thing going. So they were like, what the hell, you know? And so like another year, in 1929, this town called College Corner, which is on the border of Indiana and Ohio. It's a little town. It's like 500 people. And they had their own police officer. He was just a merchant cop who'd walk around at night, make sure the doors were locked and no one was stealing from anything like that. And he was found dead in the morning and laying in the alley. And he had come across Willard somehow, and Willard shot him. And it was kind of weird because it happened right where the border is. And It was like his gun was like in Ohio and his body was in Indiana. And there was all kinds of arguments about that. It went on and on in the paper and stuff. But, you know, this is like a small town. It's only 8 miles from Liberty, too. So this Carson guy, he turns into like the bogeyman of the Midwest. You know, it's like, oh, he's going to get you. So then, okay, so years go by. It's 1935 in Anderson, Indiana. This officer, Frank Libby, he gets called that there's a suspicious vehicle idling with its lights on in this quiet neighborhood. It's just a little town, you know. And there's an idling there for a couple hours. Of course, he was with a woman. So the cop goes up, and Willard jumps out and shoots him 4 times in the chest, just kills him right there. And, you know, this is a small town. The cop gets killed. It's like a big deal. So, you know, they try to shake everybody down. This woman that suspected of being in the vehicle wouldn't talk, and, you know, they never got it. In the meantime, you know, his mother died and stuff, and he was supposed to get, you know, inherit a bunch of money. So the cops were, you know, he would also send postcards to different police departments taunting them you know, that they'll never get him and things like that, which is like really something. So by 1939, his sister and the police over there in Liberty were wondering, they haven't heard from him in a while. So they made up a new reward, and they sent out, you know, wanted posters to all different police departments all over the place. So in 1941, in July, Ottawa County Sheriff Frank Van Etta, and this is in Michigan, the west coast of Michigan on Lake Huron, a very beautiful area, beautiful beaches, and, you know, it's like kind of a vacation area for people from Chicago. They used to have ships that would go from Milwaukee and Chicago over to Grand Haven in that area. You know, it was that popular. So the chief's looking through, and he sees the picture, and he goes, hey, that looks like this vagrant guy that we found washed up on the beach in 1939. They knew him as Lloyd Kane. And they found him on the beach in August. It was August 3rd, of all things, right? August 3rd, yep. Again. He was in his swimming trunks, and he, you know, the Lake Michigan undertows are notorious. They'll just take you out and just drown you and then dump you on the shore a couple of days later. So they found him, and they just thought, well, you know, bury him in a pauper's grave. And he realized that that was that guy. And so he contacted the police back in Indiana and his sister, and they exhumed his body, and they identified him from a chipped tooth and a bullet scar, and he had a missing right pinky finger. That's another thing, missing digits in this 1926 thing. So, yeah, it turned out that that was him, and he had died of drowning 16 years after he had murdered his father.
Yeah.
And he had killed two police officers, and, you know, that terrified people for years, and Lake Michigan got him. And
yeah,
who knows
like
how
say,
long he would have kept doing it.
Yeah, like you say, if it wasn't for Lake Michigan's undertow, that prevented him from more killing, absolutely.
Absolutely. And I had another story, too, about this guy in Hammond, Indiana, which is the area where my mother's from, a lot of my family. And a social worker came because this guy just pretty much just quit working, and he had 9 kids and no furniture and stuff. Social worker stopped by. He ended up shooting her in the head, and he ran off, and they never found him. The son said about 10 years later, he heard that he was living in a farm in Michigan. He went up and saw him, and a couple of years later, he went back, and the farm was burnt down, and the neighbors said, yeah, he just moved away after that happened. That's another guy that just got away with it.
Interesting. We're going to talk about one more story here, and this is, again, a very bizarre one, but much different than the other stories, and it's titled Like a Girl Who Married Dear Old Dad. This is in Springfield,
yeah.
Massachusetts, and a person named Richard Bierce, and you always say he was an oddball. He was 26 years old, living with his divorced mother, Etta, and his father, Fred Bierce. They had had an amicable divorce, and he's a county treasurer for Hampton County. Tell us about life with Richard Bierce and what happens.
Yeah, he was another only child, and he was, you know, spoiled rotten about things. He had a degree in mechanical engineering, Northwestern University. Class of 1924, so he's a pretty young guy. And they said he was a nice guy, but he had an explosive temper.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a job at the Springfield Gaslight Company, and he quit it because he thought he could make more money with his electrical engineering degree or mechanical engineering degree someplace else. Instead of looking for a job first, he just quit it. I guess that's how good the economy was then. You know, it's like you could just quit your job and go get another one.
Yeah.
But he was kind of bummed about what he did, and his parents sent him on a vacation. Like I said, he was pretty spoiled. The homes where he lived are all still there, too. So he went to the beach out in Saybrook, Connecticut for a 2-week vacation. And he met this woman, Marie Wilson. She was from Springfield, too. She was 21. And they fell madly in love. And they wanted to get married, like, right away and things. So they're back in Springfield. And they went on a date and stuff. And she told him when he was dropping her off that she had a boyfriend when she met him. But she wrote him a Dear John letter and broke up with him because she wanted to be with Richard. And Richard just freaked out, just totally lost it. Unreasonably, you know. And he took Marie home and went back home to the home that he lived with his mother, which that home was for sale when I was writing this book. It's just kind of odd. Still there. So about 6:30 in the morning, the next day, neighbors heard a big commotion in the house, and they actually called the police. Cops came, didn't see anything, so they left. And they got called again, saying there was more sound. So the cops came and kicked down the house. And what they found was Richard Bierce covered in his mother's blood, cradling her naked body on the intestine-laden, gore-covered kitchen floor. He had suffocated her revived her, and then suffocated her again until she died. And then using his bare hands, he pulled out her eyeballs and her internal organs, including her heart. He did not use a knife. He used his bare hands.
Wow. Incredible.
So, yeah, that's just amazingly horrible. Mm-hmm. And he was all historical and said to the cops, "I did it because I love her. My love was intense, and that's why he mutilated her, to clean her soul from sin."
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was just horrible, and his girlfriend Marie was just in shock. She said that he told her that when they get married, he wanted to live with his mother, and she, like, laughed it off because she said, you know, the house kind of gave her creeps and stuff, and she didn't want to live with her mother-in-law. You know, they're young kids. They're in their early 20s,
sure.
You know.
Yeah. Sure.
So he admitted to the murder, and, you know, of course, his father, you know, helped him with his with his legal fees and stuff, and he ended up getting put in Bridgewater State Hospital, which I guess was pretty notorious at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He was there for 22 years, and he was in isolation the entire time. So
wow.
His father pulled as much strings as he could, got him into a nicer hospital, and then eventually got him pardoned from the governor. And he brought him home, but he died just a few weeks later. His father died just after he brought his son back home from the insane asylum. And so for 6 months, he stayed at the house at 1075 Boston Road for about 6 months, and then he checked himself back out. When he was in the nicer mental hospital, they would let him out. He could walk around in town and things like that. So, but he ended up living to age 59, died of a heart attack on my birthday. Actually, I was a year old, on April 28, 1959. He was still a voluntary patient there. But what would make this guy, I know, what would make this guy, what could be so bad? And how badly did he have to really click to do that? You know, with the world as his oyster at that point, too.
Well, obviously, but he was insane. All his actions after that date, obviously, a simple, I mean, obviously, he was jealous. And a lot of people have experienced those feelings, but he went
yeah.
home and did some bizarre, like you say, I mean, I've heard of people taking out organs out of a body, but they used a knife. I mean, they weren't surgeons,
yeah.
and that's shocking enough, but to somebody to rip organs out of a body with their bare hands, again, it does point to obvious insanity. So,
yeah,
certainly.
I mean, I have never heard of that.
No. No,
yeah,
that's beyond
the
pale.
I've never heard of that. Yeah, even in, you know, Aborigine stories, you know, Captain Cook and all those things, or American Indians and all that, I had never heard of anything like that.
Well, what I find is, what I found is doing this for so many years and reading is that the psychopathic killer or the insane killer, both seem to have this extraordinary almost superhuman strength and endurance and stamina to do what they're doing, to be able to do what they're doing. Incredible amount
yeah.
of effort and strength. And this story demonstrates even more, you know, strength
yeah.
to be able to do something like, and anger. And yeah, so it is
yeah.
a horrifying story.
Yeah. It doesn't get any stranger than that. You know, at the same time in 1926, there was, not only was there a lot of, like, the gangster wars happening, you know, that was all over the place. I mean, this book could have been the size of a, you know, 1980 L.A. phone book if I would
yeah.
have really gone
sure.
through. I just picked out the ones that weren't, like, mob-related or, you know,
mm-hmm.
just like the
yeah.
average person that did something like that. Because, you know, at the same time that ape guy was running around Canada and America killing middle-aged mm. landladies. He'd go in and see about renting a room, and he'd kill these landladies and rape them after death and stuff like that. And at the same time that was happening, 1926 was just crazy. The first day of 1926 at the Rose Bowl Parade, the bleachers fell and injured like 100 people and killed one person. You know, it was just like in August, 300 people died of alcohol poisoning in New York City. Can you imagine if that happened now?
Sure.
I mean, that's like, you know, drinking tainted booze. And up on Lake Ontario, in outside of Buffalo, like 15 people got pulled out by an undertow and drowned. And a bunch of them were like a bunch of high school kids that were all there together. And others were just people just having a good time. But this weird undertow happened and pulled everybody out, drowned all these people.
Yeah.
It was just a very odd year.
Could you tell us a little bit about a few of the other, just a basic outline of a couple of the other stories in your book, like Just a Good Old Boy, which is another fascinating story. Tell us about this one a little bit, an outline of it, and a couple of the other ones that you include in this book.
Collection. Well, George Jefferson Hassel was like this psychopathic guy. Just, you know, one of those guys that kind of, he was a good old boy, got along with everybody. And was always just like a manual laborer. He found out his brother died, got kicked by mules, so he went to his farm and ended up marrying his wife, and he inherited like six kids. And at the same time, there's just all these weird things that happened, like his brother's oldest daughter, he met her in California once, ended up having an incestuous affair with her and had a kid with her. And she showed up at the ranch, and things kind of came to a head, and his wife found out and was really angry. He was drinking one night, and she got mad about that, and he killed everybody in the family and took a couple of days to do it as people came into the house. He told everybody that they were moving, like they already moved to Oklahoma, and he was selling their stuff. While he was having his auction, a wagon went over where he had buried them and sunk into it, and they found all the bodies right there. So the sheriff just happened to be there when it happened. So after they arrest this guy, they start finding out all these people that he had married and things like that. And it turned out that he had had a family in 1918 in Whittier, California. And he had three adopted children and his wife. He said he was going to join the army. She said, "You're crazy. You're like 40 years old." And he killed them and buried them on their floor, too. So you get this like sheriff from Texas calling LA sheriffs saying, you know, "Hey, there's this house, you know, that has like five bodies." And they were like, "Yeah, right." And they went and investigated, and there were like five bodies down there too. And he loved to talk to the press. He was just like a horrible, horrible person. One of the weirdest things I thought was in Nebraska, not too far out from Omaha, there were a band of gypsies that were horse traders. And, weird thing happened is this woman, the gypsy father, his wife died, and his son married this woman, but he married her, but it was really his father, Frank Mason's girlfriend. And so they were, you know, he was married to his son, but they were like running out together at hotel rooms in Omaha, and she was buying the latest fashions and bobbing her hair and stuff. And while she was getting her hair bobbed in a barber shop, and this is in this little town called Lea, Nebraska, and it's still only like 500 people, another one of his sons walked in and shot her in the head and said that, you know, he got rid of her finally and stuff. And it was just really strange because his son that had married her, her name was Fame Schaefer, he quit the gypsy family, and you know, none of them had an education. They were all illiterate and stuff. And he was only like 18 years old, and he completely left his family and became a farmer and got an education and stuff. But you know, you don't think of flappers or gypsies in rural Nebraska. And
no.
That's a lot of the thing, you know, is that, you know, people say, like, you know, they think, they like to think that when women's got the rights to marry and think, or to vote and stuff, that all kind of happened slowly, but it didn't. Like, women just kicked off their, you know, their corsets and said, "Screw that, man, I'm having fun," you know. There's another guy in Michigan who, this white supremacist, he was like the leader of the Ku Klux Klan in Muskegon County in Michigan, didn't like this guy who had just won, like road commissioner, something like that. And so this guy, the road commissioner guy, had like a bar, restaurant type place, little resort thing on the lake, real nice. His daughter was getting married, and they were getting all these packages and letters from everywhere. And he was, he gave them that package to open. He said, "Oh, this has got to be for you, you know, it's this, you know, package." And it blew up. It turned out that that Klansman guy had made a bomb and meant for the road commissioner guy to explode. But instead, it killed his daughter and her husband. They were getting married like the next day. And
wow.
killed the road commissioner, and he got caught right away because he had used the postage that was like metered, and the mail guy remembers it. And one of his jobs was to blow up stumps, and Michigan was full of stumps because they cut down all the trees, and by then they wanted to clear the land, and so he knew about explosives. But they found the triggering device from the old rifle that was that the part fit perfectly that was in the bomb. I think that part had like went into the man, was they found it inside him, like it was part of the shrapnel or something, but it was part of the triggering device. But, you know, you got this little rural town in Michigan and, you know, bomb blows up, basically blows up the whole place. You know, just strange. Another one was this rancher out in Montana, like outside of Yellowstone, and he killed his like 18-year-old girlfriend and tried to make it seem that she was trying to kill him and stuff. You know, this guy was like 45 and she was like 18, and just this crazy, you know, thing of lies. And you know, the funny thing is that he was like convicted immediately because the jury of his peers were like ranchers, farmers, miners, cowboys. It's like, you know, they didn't take any kind of baloney about it, you know.
Right. You have... sorry, I just wanted to mention before...
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
We have no more time. That just all of the chapters in the book, the story is The Farmer in the Dell, I Love a Man in Uniform, A Moron with a Gun, Pocket Full of Bullets, Like a Hole in the Head, The End of the Frontier, The Guy Who Never Got a Break, Dumkopf, Michigan Mail Bomb, So My Toddler is an Axe Murderer, Incest in Seattle,
yeah.
Urge for Overkill, Three Bullets for Her Husband, Panic in Cicero, Spotty Excuse, Oh My Papa, The Phantom Killer, He Auto Stayed Home, Like a Girl That Married Dear Old Dad, Really Bad Dad, Darn Those Socks, Jitney's Bill's Cafe and the Cozy Cafe, oh, and we got a bunch more. So there's numerous stories in here, all of them in the same ilk as this. Incredible, sensational stories of 1926 and the year that Americans went berserk, even more so than any other time in history. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about 1926, Homicide in America. For those that might want to check out other work of yours, and how can they get a copy of Homicide in America? Where do they go? For
Through Amazon. I put it out through Amazon. So it's on my my author page, David Kolchik's author page on Amazon. I have my five other books on there. And that's where you can get it right now.
Well, that's great. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about 1926, Homicide in America. A fascinating, fascinating collection. David, thank you very much, David Kolchik, for this
thank
interview.
You.
You have a great evening.
Thank you. You
Good
too.
Night.